Well, if you'd like, you can be opening your Bibles up to 1 Kings chapter 6. And the words, or the title for our lesson this evening, comes from the last words in the book of Judges, chapter 21 and verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And the way those words fall, standing as the last words of the book, would indicate to us that the writer wants us to understand, here's the explanation for what you have been reading about. And what we have been reading about in the book of Judges is terrible. Terrible unfaithfulness, a cycle of repentance after some punishment, but after some times of peace, immediately Israel goes right back to worshiping idols. And part of the problem was the fact that the Canaanites had been left in the land as a constant temptation. They're constantly there tempting them with their lifestyle and with their false religious practices. And of course, all of this was because of their initial disobedience to drive the Canaanites out of the land. So we're going to kind of do that this evening. We're going to do a flyover of the book of Judges, and some of the things that I've put together I hope will make sense to you and be helpful to you. And at the end of the lesson, we're just going to try to draw some applications for ourselves that we might see. The book of Judges, you go from Numbers, which is pretty bad, but the book of Judges may be worse because there are some good things happening at the beginning of Numbers. You know, Moses and Aaron are still alive, and they haven't disobeyed God yet. So there's this movement, you know, there's this movement toward Canaan. There's this positive feeling even beyond the golden calf in Exodus. There's been somewhat of a recovery from that, it would seem, at least just from reading. But when the people refuse to take the land, it's pretty much downhill in the book of Numbers from there. But there's hope in Deuteronomy, that Israel can be successful, that they can recover from the stumbling of the 40 years and from the failure of the previous generation to go and take the land. But they don't. And while there are highs throughout the Old Testament, it's really a tragedy in the end of people who had a tremendous opportunity to know God, a tremendous opportunity to be light for God in the world as He is working His plan to bring His Son into the world, and they just don't do that. And as faithful and consistent as a leader, as Joshua was as a leader, what we're going to see in the book of Judges is that the people turn away pretty quickly after he dies. And so there's going to be some things that we say about that. I want to begin here in 1 Kings 6 because I just want to maybe familiarize you, if this is not something that you've thought of in a while or not something that you're familiar with. I want you to just understand that there's a huge chunk of period when Israel conquers the land. There's a huge chunk of period when they didn't have an earthly king. You know, they had the priests, and after Moses died, Joshua kind of stood. We might think of Joshua as a judge, kind of, you know, representing the leadership, but also elders in each tribe, the priesthood and the high priest, you know, Eleazar serving with Joshua, kind of leading the people. But there was no really centralized government. There was no, this guy's the king, the buck stops with him. No, there were teachers of the law, and there were priests who would have been overseeing the worship specifically. But you know, people just were given the opportunity and the freedom and the responsibility to live for God throughout the land of Israel. So here is where, thinking about 1 Kings 6 and Solomon's reign, helps us just a little bit. I'm going to go through this. I'm going to put this information up here and just give you some idea of how we might go through the process and figure out this chunk, this period of Old Testament history that we would describe as the time of the judges. So we're using the approximate figure of 960 for the beginning of Solomon's reign. In verse 1 it says, "It came to pass came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. So this tells us, so in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, approximately 956, 480 years prior, the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. These are approximate figures, but I think people would probably see that they're pretty close and feel like that there are some external sources that would give some confirmation for the numbers that we're talking about here, but just giving you an idea of how we might go through the process. So 1436 is roughly, we might say, the date of the Exodus. And then Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. So that brings us forward to 1396 in the Old Testament. As we move closer to the coming of Christ, the numbers get smaller. They're going down as we get closer to the coming of Christ. And so we've got 1396 here. And then in Joshua 14 and verse 10, Caleb asks for his inheritance. It had been about 5 years since they crossed the Jordan. So that it gives us, again, an approximate figure for when most of the fighting in the book of Joshua ended. Most of the major battles had been won and cities been captured by about 1391 B.C. Now, what the book of Judges tells us is that in the next generation, Judges chapter 2 and verse 10, you're welcome to turn over there. In Judges chapter 2 and verse 10, the very next generation after Joshua, Israel began to become unfaithful. So all that generation was gathered to their fathers, the generation of Joshua and the elders who served with him. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And Israel began to have these problems, serving the idols of the people around them, being oppressed by oppressors that the Lord sent because they were violating their covenant. And then, so the next generation, we'll just somewhere between 20 and 50 years, we'll say, we'll give ourselves, we'll just start with a period of about 20 years. Joshua dies. And then again, this is an approximate date here. Saul begins to reign in 1040 BC. He was the first king of the what we sometimes call the United Kingdom, when all the tribes were being ruled together under one king. So there's kind of a period where we might see these judges falling into. It's a period probably about 330 years, and there are some questions about that we probably just won't go into at this time, but just kind of giving you a basic idea of the period of time that we're talking about. And I want to talk to you now about some of the stories. Maybe not the stories that you are as familiar with, but if you're familiar with Samson, you've heard of the story of Samson. Samson was one of the judges. You would read about him in the book of Judges. Maybe you've heard of Samuel. And Samuel was the last judge. His story kind of transitions and begins in the book of 1 Samuel, but it was still of the time of the judges when there was no king, and eventually Samuel would anoint Saul to be the first king over Israel. Eli might be a name that you recognize. Gideon might be a name that you recognize. These were some of the judges I think that we're more familiar with. Let me talk to you a little bit about a man named Ehud. Judges chapter 3, and I may just read some here from chapter 3, the kind of give you a little bit of the story, set it up for you. So you notice in verse 14 that the sons of Israel are serving Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. They have become unfaithful. They are serving idols, and the Lord is allowing Moab to oppress the Israelites. This is the cycle that we see over and over in the book of Judges. When the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud the son of Gera the Benjamite. He was a left-handed man, and the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. He who had made himself a sword, which had two edges, a cubit in length, and he bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. And it came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." And he said, "Keep silence." And all who attended left him. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, "I have a message from God for you." And he arose from his seat. Ehud stretched out his left hand and took the dagger from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. The handle also went in after the blade, and the flesh closed around the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly. And the refuse came out. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule and shut the doors of the roof chamber behind them and locked them. This is a story that I think children, especially who are familiar with the story of the judges, I think they kind of remember this story and tend to be interested in it. I think maybe they like the detail of Ehud penetrating Moab's defenses with the unusual fact that he was left-handed. Still today, I think generally only about 10% of the population is considered to be left-handed. And so here he is, he's brought a gift. Looks like he's coming to continue in submission to the people of Moab. Maybe they check him, you know, just kind of glance because they expect him to be right-handed. Maybe they don't check him at all. And Ehud is able to get into the king's chamber with his dagger. It's one of the most instant individual judgments that we see in the Bible. I mean, this turnaround was one day they're bringing tribute, and the same day Israel is gathering together against the Moabites and being delivered by the hand of Ehud. It really just kind of sticks in our minds. It's kind of a gruesome death, which leads to an excited campaign of Israelites who are ready to follow Ehud as he delivers the people from their oppression. I think the story of Deborah and Barak, Deborah may be a name that we remember as a judge, and just their kind of their relationship. As Deborah is kind of playing the part of who is clearly described as a judge, the people are coming to her for judgment, but she's in a little bit of a different situation as a woman. We've got the people of Israel who are coming to her. She's not going out and being, you know, very public in that way. Her leadership as a judge is much different. And Barak is the one who is going to be called to lead the army against Sisera, who was the general of Jabin, the king of Hazor. And it's an interesting story, kind of back and forth. Deborah says, "The Lord has told you to go lead the army against Sisera." And Barak says, "Well, I won't go unless you go with me." He knew that the Lord was with Deborah, and he wanted the support and the encouragement of Deborah. And Deborah says, "Well, I'll go with you." You may remember this story. But the glory for the victory of the battle is going to be given to a woman, because you would not go out at the Lord's command. And so they go out and they are able to prevail over Jabin and Sisera, his general. But Sisera had run away. Do you remember that story? Sisera was able to get away from the thick of the battle. And there was kind of the Kenites, I believe, were, you know, loosely related to Moses in the past. And they were living kind of in the land as Moab, as nomads, excuse me. And Jael was the wife. And here comes Sisera. He's running away. And there's the tent. "Oh, come in, stop here." And she gives him milk, and he lies down and, you know, to rest. You can just imagine, he's been in battle, they're losing, he's running away. And while he was sleeping, she took a tent peg and drove it through his head, basically nailing his head to the floor with a tent peg. Wow. And Sisera, the commander of the army, was vanquished by Jael in her tent. In Judges chapter 5, we have perhaps one of the oldest songs, the Song of Miriam, on the shores of the Red Sea. My would be older, but one of the oldest psalms in the Old Testament. You notice in verse 1 it says, "Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day. When the leaders lead in Israel, the people have volunteered. Bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I to the Lord, I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel." And in their song, they mention Shamgar, one of the other judges. They mention Jael, who vanquished Sisera. One of the oldest songs that we have in the Old Testament. And then you've got the story of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. And if you'll look in Ruth chapter 1, in verse 1 it tells us, "In the days when the judges governed, there was a famine in the land." And I think probably a lot of people may be familiar with the story of Ruth, who was a young Moabite maiden who had been married to someone from Israel. There was famine in the land, which tells us that it was a time probably of unfaithfulness. And so Naomi and her husband had gone to Moab, presumably because there was food there. And while they are there, their two sons marry young girls from the land of Moab. And while they are there, Naomi's husband dies. Her two sons die, and there she is with her two daughters-in-law from Moab. And Naomi sends Ruth back to her own people, both of the young girls back to their own people. But in verse 16, chapter 1, Ruth refuses. It's perhaps one of the greatest statements of commitment and devotion and relationship in the whole Bible. Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." It's one of my favorite verses in the Bible, favorite statements in the Bible. It's such a touching story where you've got these two people who come back from Moab pretty broken. They've lost their husbands. They're coming back. They hear that there's food in the land of Israel, and they go back to the land where Naomi was from, in the land of Judah. They go back, and they're living off the gleanings of a man named Boaz. Basically, Ruth is going out, and whatever scraps are left behind, she's gathering those scraps up, and that's what her and Naomi are living on. Wow. And so in all of this, it works out that Boaz is a near kinsman who has the opportunity, according to the law, to take Naomi as his wife and to take up the estate of her dead husband. And so that property would be given to this son, the child of Ruth that would be born. And so they begin to figure out who one another are. And by the end of the book, Ruth and Boaz have been married. And Naomi is rejoicing over the birth of Ruth's young son named Obed. And what we find out in chapter 4 is that this whole story was about the family that would eventually bring David into the world. Notice that in verse 18, verse 17 and 18, it says, "He is the father of Jesse, the father of David." And then they take the generations all the way back to Perez from the book of Genesis. Perez was born Hezron, and Hezron Ram Amminadab. And going on to verse 22, Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse was born David. So this is a tender, incredible story showing us that even though things were pretty terrible in the time of the judges, they could be, there were still faithful people in Israel, and God was still watching over them. And those faithful people, in the midst of all this, you know, just unfaithfulness and disregard for holiness, those faithful people, God was using them to further progress his plan to bring his son into the world. So those are just some of the stories. I want to think about some of these lessons with you just briefly. We've mentioned the fact that the problem in the book of Judges was the Canaanites living among them. The Canaanites were idol worshipers. They had been told to drive them out of the land, not to allow them to remain. If you'll go to Deuteronomy chapter 7 with me, you will see precisely what the Lord said, precisely what the danger was. Deuteronomy 7, verses 2 through 4. Moses said, "When the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you." That's what we see playing out in the book of Judges. God didn't want the Canaanites in the land for good reason. And the book of Judges shows us the historical justification of what God had said. Why do we have to drive them out? We're in control. We control all the cities. And we're dominating them. Why do we have to drive them out? They will turn you away from your God. And so the power of peer influences is real. We've got to be honest about that and aware of that. We have to be a little bit guarded. We don't live in a land where we've got borders and people who don't believe in God, they don't live in these borders. People who are serving idols, they're not allowed to live in these borders. We don't live in that kind of situation. We're in the world, not of the world. And when we see the generation, we're talking about one generation removed from Joshua. And they don't know the Lord. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing. What that should tell us is that this will happen even if there have been very faithful people in our lives. Not being careful about peer influences. And that's if you're young or if you're old. Whatever age you may, your peers will be. If we take fire into our bosom, we will be burned. In Proverbs chapter 6, Solomon is talking specifically about the sin of adultery. He wants his son to understand, you can't do this and get away with it. There will definitely be consequences. And that may be true for adultery in a special and in a unique kind of way. But it's true with any kind of disobedience. When the Israelites were standing back, justifying themselves, hey, we're in control of all the cities. The Canaanites have no power. And they didn't drive them out the way the Lord told them to drive them out of the land. They were taking fire into their bosom. They were basically just taking what God had said and just, well, God said, don't do this, and they're just scooping it right up like hot coals in their hands. Look at what Solomon says here in verse 26. On account of a harlot, one is reduced to the loaf, to a crust of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. I think of Samson, who is perhaps one of the most fearless and impressive warriors in the entire Old Testament. Samson was not afraid of a fight. Samson once killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey. He killed a lion on the side of the road who roared at him as he was traveling to meet his future wife. Samson was not afraid of a fight. But he didn't do a very good job fighting spiritual battles. We see Samson constantly making, if not questionable choices, choices that we know were just outright wrong in his dealings, especially with women. No one is strong enough. Samson killed 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. He wasn't strong enough to play with sin and not get burned. And if he wasn't strong enough, we're not strong enough either. Sin always takes us farther than we want to go. You've heard that probably. Keeps you there longer than you intended to stay. Cost you more than you ever intended to spend. Sin, we have this idea, we're going to draw these boundaries, and so we take sin up into our bosom. We say, well, I won't get burned, and all of a sudden our clothes are on fire. Well, how did that happen? At the end of the book of Judges, in chapter 19, we have a story that sounds like Sodom and Gomorrah. But it's not Sodom. It's the land of Israel. And the compromises and the taking sin into their bosom that Israel had been practicing through this period, I think it probably cost them more than they ever intended to spend. So here is an Israelite who has stopped in to visit another Israelite. They passed by the city of Jerusalem because at that time it was controlled by Canaanite people. And so, well, we won't go there. Let's go on down to some of our kinsmen in Benjamin. Well, while he was there, it says, behold, men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him. You may remember that's exactly what they said about the angels who had come to visit Lot in Sodom. Bring these men out to us that we may have sexual relations with them. And instead, what they do is they thrust out the Levite's concubine. They send her out there. And they sexually abused her all night. And the next morning, she was dead. But we're not talking about Sodom. We're talking about Israel. This happened in Israel. And in verse 30, they say, nothing like this has ever happened or been seen since the days that the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. There are some people who are realizing, how did we get here? Power of peer influences. The problem of taking fire into our bosom, thinking that we won't get burned. This is a lesson from the book of Judges that I think is worth thinking about. And I will be honest, if we were having a Bible class, maybe we could put some suggestions out there about how to avoid this. But the fact is that people moved away from a very faithful generation. In one generation, people moved away from being very faithful to the Lord. Characterized and led by Joshua. In one generation, they went from that to not knowing the Lord. And not knowing the things that he had done. How can we explain that? Well, perhaps we can get full and forget God. Moses talked about that in Deuteronomy. You've been living out here in the wilderness. You've learned to rely on the Lord, and the Lord has tested you. Beware when you get in the land of Canaan. You're going to have houses you didn't build and vineyards that you didn't plant, and you're going to have wells that you didn't dig. Beware lest you get full and forget the Lord your God. Perhaps we ignore the warnings about the influence of peers. Perhaps the next generation says, hey, it won't happen to us. You know, I'll be honest with you. That's one thing that I hope that Kendra and I are being diligent in teaching our children, grounding our children, because you see, we had to fight our way into the faith of Christ. Our parents didn't teach us the gospel. We had to fight our battles. We had to fight and strive and go through struggles to get to the point where we are now. We protect our children from a lot of those battles. I think that it's right to do that. That we should not just be saying, hey, go out in there in the world and see if you can. No. Young children are impressionable. They are not mature enough to just, hey, go out there and see what you can. They need guidance. They need teaching. I think that we are right to protect them from some of the things that we have protected them from. But if we have any strength, me and Kendra, I think some of it has come from the fact that we had to fight battles to get to where we are. And so we've got to, while we protect them from some things, we don't protect them from everything. We don't just shield them and like, no, if you don't, no, that's all right. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. We've got to find a way to equip them with a faith that is tested. Maybe that's what we do. Maybe we could assume as parents that our children know. I mean, after all, I mean, they've been going to Bible class for 15 years. Surely they know, right? Well, they know the plan of salvation. Surely they know, what it means to serve God as a Christian. Surely they know how dependent they are on the blood of Christ for forgiveness. Right? They know, right? Do we remember what Moses told the Israelites in Deuteronomy 6? He said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." There has to be some thinking, some planning, some testing, some challenging. Because people can move away from God in one generation. And ultimately, if we move away from God, it's on us. It's on me. But Moses thought and believed, and the Lord, through Moses, is telling us that now you can teach your children to love the Lord. You can do that. You can be diligent about that, and you can help them know who God is. You can help them know how much they need Him. You can help them know that they live by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And last thing I'll say, going back to Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Think about the attitude of the people that's being described. There's no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The absence of a king that they could see made them suspect perhaps that they could escape consequences for their disobedience. They did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king. Assuming if there was a good king who was standing up and upholding the law, that even the ones who might want to disobey would be hesitant to do so. They didn't fear any consequences for disobedience. They didn't think about honoring God or pleasing Him, and they weren't very afraid of disobeying Him. And we need to see God with eyes of faith. What do I mean by that? The Israelites couldn't see a king standing there with a scepter and a sword upholding and enforcing the law. The Israelites couldn't see God holding a sword over their heads, and so they said, well, there won't be any consequences. And the consequences weren't immediate. And so they allowed themselves to trek deeper and deeper into the muck and the mire of wicked and sinful living. Perhaps they made the mistake that a lot of people seem to make in the world around us, and maybe we make this mistake sometimes. Because there are no immediate consequences, maybe we decide there will be no consequences. And so we do what is right in our own eyes. Jesus is sitting at the Father's right hand in glory, victorious over sin and death. We can't see him with our physical eyes. Yet we have sufficient evidence to realize, to know that God judges sin, that God will judge sin in the future, and that God will keep his promises through Jesus Christ. That he will judge the disobedient and reward the faithful. We understand that by faith, but that doesn't mean without any evidence. And we are responsible to examine that evidence so that we might know that there is a God who is going to call us into account. Go ahead and get your songbooks out. Don't be like the Israelites. Don't be like so many in our world today. They haven't even examined or considered the evidence, and they tell themselves, hey, there are not going to be any consequences. Just do what you want to do. Live for yourself. Live for your own desires. If you're here this evening, I suspect that that means that you have some belief, some interest in knowing whether or not Jesus is the Son of God. Maybe you've considered the evidence, and some of the things that we have said even this evening have helped you to realize your need to act upon the evidence that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Your need to give your life to Jesus, to put your faith and your trust in him, to confess him as Lord, to turn away from the sins of your past, to be renewed by the power of the gospel. You can be baptized in the name of Christ and have your sins washed away. If you're here this evening as a Christian and you need some encouragement, there's something in your life that you need help with and you want us to pray with you, we want to do that as well. We ask you to come as we sing this song together.